Before I introduce Max, I've got one story to tell you about from Peter Leggett, which I think will be known to Max, maybe to one or two other of you. Peter is one of the people we're going to be talking about this afternoon. And he was having a conversation with a bishop. And Peter and Max wrote a book about reincarnation, A Forgotten Truth, I think it was called. And so they got to the end of the discussion, and the bishop said to Peter, if I accepted reincarnation, I'd have to change my whole theology. And so this, of course, is the point, that if you accept the validity of some of the things we've been talking about today, you have to change your whole philosophy, you have to change your whole worldview. And that is not a straightforward thing to do. And I'm sure many of us in this room actually have been through this process of taking a particular view, then being radically challenged by an experience, an event, a book, a person, and then having to, you know, flip over into a different... Yes, exactly. But it's always, it implies an expansion. Now, Max is one of the, I think, almost only people now who are one of the original members of the network who were invited by, Max was invited by Peter Leggett to become a member of the network. And as far as I know, the story is that a small number of people, including Patrick Shackleton, Sir Kelvin Spencer, Peter Leggett, and others met at Exeter University, and George Laker. And George said that a carefully worded letter was going to be sent out to a few selected friends. And if you read between the lines of this letter, it would be an invitation to join the Scientific and Medical Network, or was going to become the Scientific and Medical Network. And so once you got this letter from a friend, so I thought you might be interested, probably a lot of them went in the bin. But Max was one of the people who didn't put it in the bin, and he's been a stalwart of the network ever since. He's had various roles within the network. He was on the council for many years, then he became trustee, then he became chairman of the trustees, and he's a vice president. And Max has been speaking at conferences in the network, you know, since the network started. And I think one of the early conferences in the network was at the University of Surrey on reincarnation, when Peter Leggett was still the vice chancellor, I think in 1974. And there are some proceedings of that. Then Max also spoke at a meeting, I think, in 1977, where E.F. Schumacher was one of the other speakers. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Max's memory in terms of the network is a very long one. And he, of course, knew Peter Leggett very well, knew George Blaker very well. And it is the centenary that we're celebrating this afternoon of these founders of the network. So, Max, thank you very much for joining us here and giving us the benefit of your experience and insights and recollections. Thank you.
Yes, well, as somebody said, never apologise, never explain, but apologies are, I think, on occasion necessary. David's introduction, well, it rather reminds me of the famous saying by Robbie Burns, "Oh, the gift it is to see ourselves as others see us." This is normally, very often at least, a very chastening experience, and I'm seeing myself as others see me. And I think of a rather dispiriting analogy. You know, a building's put up. It's really quite useful, and quite important organisations use it. And then it's a bit cramped, a bit old-fashioned, and the organisations move to a better building elsewhere, and the first building stands there, it gets a bit derelict, and it really gets in the way of road improvements that are about to demolish it. And suddenly, somebody points out, it's a relic of a bygone fashion of architecture and has got to have a part two conservation order put on it. And I rather feel that part two conservation order's been put on me. I've been around too long. Yeah.
Grade one listed.
Well, grade one, grade two, anyway. So here I am reminiscing on the foundation of the network. Again, with the deepest respect to those who've organised this conference, I think I've been marginally hijacked. The original conversation, as far as I remember it, was just say a few words on the founding of the network in 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I looked down here, and there's nothing else scheduled until 6:15. You will be reassured to know I will not take that time. All the same, perhaps I might do something useful, because I'm going to talk about the people who founded the network, George Blaker, Patrick Shackleton, Peter Leggett, then Sir Kevin Spencer, and two other people who aren't normally mentioned but were quite key in the founding, Geoffrey Latham and Arthur Ellison. And they came together, and in a way, their intellectual and spiritual DNA is the inheritance of the scientific medical network as it now is. And so if I just talk about these excellent people, meander on a bit, you'll get a sense of how it was we were founded as an organisation and what sort of streams of thought, of energy, came through them into us. And I'll reminisce, and I hope some use. Can I make it absolutely clear that I have not consulted any of the records? I haven't even consulted my own desultory records. This is simply my own memory, inadequate as it is, and I've already had some interesting conversations with Patrick Shackleton's daughter, Desla Greenhow, who's present with us, and she has already corrected things I'd remembered. So, you know, this is not a sort of picture of the network written on tablets of stone or letters of fire. It's beginning a rough, uncorrected draft. So we've got a number of people who came together to form the Scientific and Medical Network. The first is George Blaker. There are people here who remember him quite well. George is a very interesting character. You met him, you said, what a nice choice of chap he is. A bit modest, a bit reticent. You know, pleasant sort of person. Remembered him, but not particularly. It's only after you talked to him for some time and knew him for quite a good while that being, and he was a genuinely modest person, somehow he retained a sort of simplicity of character, you know, despite being a very, very intelligent man, having had a fascinating and very important career. He was one of the heaven-born. He was one of the thousand or so Englishmen, Scotsmen, Welshmen, Irishmen, who ran India well within the lifetime of people present here. India was run at the top by just a thousand or so people at the top of the Indian civil service. By India, I mean not only present-day India, population of a billion, nuclear-armed superpower, but also Pakistan. The British Raj in India was the whole of the Indian subcontinent. I may say it's a matter of intense embarrassment this is the case. Anybody sensitive to modern diplomacy knows there's quite a bit of prickliness between Britain and India. You know, there's a tremendous sentimental feeling about the British Raj, people looking back in Britain towards it. Tremendous embarrassment in India. How was it possible that just a few thousand Englishmen, you know, Welshmen, Irishmen, Scotsmen, ruled us? How is it? And they don't like it and don't like to remember it. This is quite a considerable problem. Why was it that George and his confreres ruled India? Well, first of all, they were very, very intelligent. Secondly, they were totally and absolutely devoted to the welfare of the people they ruled, according to their opinion, their lives. Thirdly, they were totally incorruptible in a society where corruption was traditionally endemic. And fourthly, they were totally impartial in a society riven by deep racial and even deeper religious divisions. they were totally impartial. And lastly, they did fit into the Hindu scheme of society, which is sort of a caste-based system. And they were simply a caste of super Brahmins on the top. And lastly, as throughout history, it was always the Indians who ruled India anyway. It was just they were just at the top directing everybody else. And they did it very well, with remarkably little difficulty. There were movements for independence, which were sort of corralled. But George was there. I don't know if I tell any stories about his time as an administrator in India. when he was an administrator in what is now the Punjab in Pakistan, he noticed silver coins that were quite ancient. And so he started collecting them rather craftily, because in that part of the world, you didn't put your savings or the family fortune in a bank or in a unit trust. You put it in silver coins under the bed. And sometimes the silver coins went from one generation to the next. And he found that silver coins he was collecting went back to the Mughal emperors of the sort of 17th, 16th century and Hindu rulers before them, and even one or two of them, to the successors of Alexander the Great before the time of Christ. And he made this collection, and finally he did sell it many, many years later and give the proceeds to the network. Another very interesting thing about George's career in India, was that he was at one of the turning points of history when history didn't turn. This was 1943, when the Japanese had overrun Singapore and Malaya and Burma and were on the frontiers of India. And the British Army in India was, first of all, defending the frontier in Assam against the Japanese, and secondly, holding down India, which was restive, searching for independence. And Winston Churchill, great defender of the empire, for heaven's sake, great imperialist, but also, like any successful politician, a pragmatic and ruthless realist, realised that something had to be done. And he sent Sir Stafford Cripps, remember, 1943, national government, Winston Churchill conservative, but Stafford Cripps, left-wing Labour, but all part of the British government. Stafford Cripps was sent to India to offer in the Indian leaders independence if they would then have a dominion status like Australia or Canada, then declare war on Japan. The leaders were Pandit Nehru and Mahatma Gandhi. They were released from house arrest, sent to Simla to negotiate. And George Blaker was the man, link man, for Sir Stafford Cripps. He was, you know, the civil servant, link man, the whole business. Nehru was quite happy to accept Indian independence and declare war on Japan. Gandhi, pacifist, wouldn't declare war on Japan. He wouldn't declare war on Britain. He wouldn't declare war on anybody. So the whole thing fell flat. So India did not get its independence in 1943. And one can speculate what would have happened in subsequent history if Sir Stafford Cripps and indeed George in the background had been successful. Maybe Pakistan would never have split away. Maybe the whole history of South Asia would have been different. Not to be. That was Gandhi's pacifism. Interesting issue. However, after the Second World War, India became independent, and George was found a job in the Ministry of Education and Science. And there he found himself in contact, of course, with scientists. Other thing about George, he was obviously a brilliant administrator, a great intellectual. But you remember Pin Van Lommel talking about openings to a universal consciousness. Talking to this audience, I'm sure there must be more than one person present who knows personally what he was talking about, if only for a nanosecond. something beyond the personal, emerging into a greater power of energy. I know from George, he had this experience at least twice. Once was in the mountains of Iran, Persia. Second was a stile in Surrey, somewhere near here. But these were vital experiences to George. He did know there was another and a beyond. And in his experience as a senior civil servant in the Department of Education and Science, he occasionally came across the odd scientist also knew. He came across an awful lot of scientists that didn't. But interestingly, I don't know whether Sir Calvin Spencer was the chief scientific officer for his ministry or another ministry.
Ministry of Power,
was it? I'm anxious for correction and addition. Anyhow, he came across Sir Calvin Spencer, a chief scientific officer for a ministry, and one knows how cautious one has to be in these matters. But gradually, the odd conversational lead from George was taken up by the odd conversational comment from Calvin, and in the end, they realised they both knew what they're talking about. And Calvin Spencer, I do remember him saying this, how for him, his motto in life was a famous saying by Isaac Newton. When Isaac Newton was complimented on his great discoveries of gravitation and the theory of light, said, "I am but as a child on a beach who sees a few attractive shells and picks them up, while before me the whole ocean of existence is unexplored." And that was Calvin Spencer's view of scientific knowledge. Excellent, interesting, and extremely limited. And because of his contact with Sir Calvin, George began to realise that there was something that ought to be done in terms of science. That there were here and there open-minded scientists that will pursue truth, again, Pim van Lommel's point, without the restriction of a materialistic dogma. So that's George Blaker, one of the founders. We take him up, he retired, and we come to the foundation of the network, which I think it was 1973. So that's George. Now, Patrick Shackleton. I only knew Patrick Shackleton after the foundation of the network, and during that period of 6 years, in fact, the headquarters of the network at its first beginning was where Patrick lived in Sidmouth, Devon. But I didn't know much about his career before then. All I knew was that he was Dean of Medicine at Southampton University. Obviously, therefore, an expert, a dean of postgraduate medicine, therefore an expert in orthodox medicine, all its forms and all its development. He'll be following all the latest developments of medical science. He was also a healer. As a practicing medical man, he also laid on hands to heal. I don't know how he got away with it. He must have sworn his patients to secrecy. Because if anybody... Did he? There's no...
He didn't swear his patients to secrecy, that was for sure. He just did it through osmosis.
They didn't denounce him, any of them, did they?
No.
Because, I mean, they're direct. Any patient, any of his patients who had gone to his colleagues and said, "That Dr. Shackleton laid his hands on to heal me," that'd be the finish of Patrick's career. I mean, Dean of Medicine he might be, but can you imagine the meeting of the BMA as he's sort of expelled with bell, book and candle? But he was a healer, and he was obviously interested in the wilder and wider frontiers of medicine. And he also felt he wanted to find a network of people like himself, were orthodox medical experts, but knew there was more to medicine, more to the healing of illness, more to the maintaining the wellness of the human body than giving pills and slicing out bits of skilled surgery. You know, we just wanted a network, a medical network. And the story goes that George Blaker got a telephone call one day from a voice. He said, doesn't matter who I am, I'm Andrew Grzewski, I'm a Polish priest, but I do not matter. What does matter is that I hear you are thinking of founding a scientific network, a network of scientists who want to explore the wider field of science. Now, it so happens there's somebody, Patrick Shackleton, who's Dean of Medicine at Southampton University, who's trying to form a medical network. Why don't you two get together? So George says, right, yes, I'll phone up Patrick Shackleton. He phones up Patrick. He says, Miss Andrew Grzewski, how does he know about me? I don't know how he knows anything about you. I don't know. And we never found out how Andrew Grzewski knew about George Blaker's plans. He obviously knew about Patrick's plans because Patrick Shackleton actually knew Andrew. But the two people got together, Patrick Shackleton, George Blaker, normal meeting in a gentleman's club in London, decided to found the SMN. They brought in Sir Gavin Spencer, and they also brought in Peter Leggett. Now, Peter, at that time, was Vice-Chancellor of Surrey University, but he had a connection with George going right back. I think they were both on the same stairwell at Trinity College, Cambridge, as undergraduates, and had knew each other from then onwards. Peter Leggett was an interesting character. He was a brilliant mathematician, and during the Second World War, he was employed by the Air Ministry to look at where bombs had dropped and how they'd been dropped and how efficient the RAF was in dropping bombs. You know, you had an air raid, and then a reconnaissance plane would go over later, suitably high up, take photographs in daylight and where all the bombs had fallen. And Peter would look at the pictures and say, well, you say you totally destroyed a target, which is a chemical works. You missed it completely. And incidentally, it looks as though some people dropped their bombs as soon as they came under anti-aircraft fire a long way away and scuttled for home or whatever. Anyhow, it was partly Peter's reports and other scientists that convinced, in fact, Harris and indeed Churchill, the RAF couldn't hit selected targets. You couldn't send them out selectively to destroy arms factories. The only thing you could do was to send them to a rather large target, like a large city, and tell them to drop bombs on that, which they did. Now, there's been a memorial to Bomber Command recently, and you might have been aware of the controversy as to why it's taken over 70 years, to have any memorial to Bomber Command, because the whole thing is a bit morally ambiguous. I mean, there were 60,000 men who died courageously in Bomber Command, but then there was 600,000 German civilians, men, women and children, who were killed as a result of mass attacks on German cities. And there's a sort of moral ambiguity in all this. So you think of these RAF pilots, nice young man, they wouldn't have kicked a dog when they walked down a pavement, let alone stuck a bayonet in a single German child. Yet with the detachment of aerial warfare, you could drop high explosive and incendiary bombs to blow to bits and burn to death lots and lots of German children, women and men. And Peter, after the war, went to Germany to, you know, check his mathematics up. He was very quiet about this. I discussed this with very, very few people. but he felt a certain moral responsibility, you know, for this death and destruction. And this came with him. Something else, again, I talk about the Blicks that Pim Bam Rommel talked about. Peter was, I think, at that time principal of, I think it was South West London Polytechnic, which he was going to transform into Surrey University. And he stepped off a commuter train at Waterloo Station. And then among the crowd and the bustle, suddenly felt everything filled with love and light. This sort of a transpersonal experience, which was went extremely deep with him. And he continued to be a brilliant university administrator. But he also went in for quite deep meditation and became quite an expert on esoteric knowledge, you know, the other side. So that was Peter Leggett drawn in as a founder. So we've got George Baker, Paddy Shackleton, Kevin Spencer, Peter Leggett. I think it's the centenary of Peter Leggett and George Baker, isn't it? So, you know, centenary making those two. Patrick's age, I'm less certain of. I ought, I think, to mention to other people who are normally thought of as founders, but who were drawn in right at the beginning and also contributed their intellectual DNA, as it were, to spiritual DNA, to the scientific medical network. One is Geoffrey Latham, who just departed this existence this year. Geoffrey, ordinary background, got a scholarship, was about to go to university at the beginning of the Second World War, but instead, you know, had to do military service and was in the Merchant Navy. He was torpedoed four times in the Battle of the Atlantic, and one time managed to get into a lifeboat and then spent, I think it was 8 days in the Atlantic winter before he was rescued. 8 days in open lifeboat in Atlantic winter was quite an experience, but he survived it. He survived the war, went back to study, graduated PhD, studied psychology, and became a lecturer in psychology. Now, this morning, if you remember, I think it was Peter Fenwick, who was answering the question, what do you do about awakening the insight of scientists? And say, the only thing you can do is be a lecturer and talk sane ideas and try to pursue proper science unhindered by dogma. Well, Geoffrey Latham is a lovely example of somebody who, well, half managed it anyway. Because Geoffrey studied psychology and had no doubt that we have minds. Not everybody here is shaken by the idea that you've all got inner minds. Believe me, as a psychology lecturer in the 1950s, that was a very, very heretical idea. People didn't have minds in those days. Not officially, not according to either philosophy or official philosophy or official psychology. It was in psychology, it was the time of ruthless behaviorism, the ideas of Pavlov and then Skinner. A thought was a quiet action. I remember going around a university psychology laboratory, and a psychology laboratory was two things. It had a lot of apparatus for telling quickness of reflexes, because action was the only thing you ever knew about anybody. And it has cages for experiments on pigeons. And that's human psychology, behaviorism. And Geoffrey Latham just would not have it and argued against it. And we heard from David this morning that in Cambridge University today, you've got a highly materialist attitude, and they reduce minds to brains At least they admit the sunning to be reduced to a brain. Whereas when Jeffrey Latham was a lecturer in psychology, they didn't even acknowledge there was anything to reduce the brain at all. And he did have an influence in forcing psychology to admit there's such a thing as a mind which human beings possess. Jeffrey was very much concerned with the peak experience ideas of Maslow, very much concerned with Jungian psychology. And at least he had some sort of redemptive influence on psychology. He was also a brilliant lecturer. There must be people here who remember Jeffrey Latham, who was not only a very, very good lecturer, he had a lovely sense of quiet, sense of humour. I only wish I had his ability to illustrate ideas with a deft joke. But he had it, and it was very, very good. Somebody else who had an influence quite early on was Professor Arthur Ellison, not normally mentioned, but he was in at the beginning. He was a professor of engineering, and one of his expertises was linear magnetism, using linear magnetism as a means of rapid transport. He got all the theory worked out. Subject to correction, somebody here been on the rapid transit from Shanghai Airport to central Shanghai? You have. Does it work on that system, linear magnetism?
You can, it's a train, which is three times faster than any train here. You can have a full glass of water without dropping. It's so quiet and fast. Fascinating.
Well, the Chinese have made... am I right, yeah. Eric? Yeah, well, what was Arthur Ellison's dream, and in fact, theoretical calculation, nobody have took it up in this country. The Chinese have done it, and I've not been on that particular route, but I gather it's quite impressive. Thank you. Yeah, that was Arthur Ellison. But Arthur was also very interested in the frontiers of experience. I think he was president of the SPR at one time. Yes. And I think there's something about his career that must also enter the DNA of the network. I must tell the story. So Arthur is interested in SPR. You know how you get these various mediums who can see auras. They look at you, and they are fingers all various colours, you know, you can see the aura. So Arthur decided to investigate the looking at the aura, and he sort of erected a screen, you see, and said, OK, you've got an observer over there, and now, can you see this aura? Oh, yes. How far in front of the fingers of the aura? Oh, 10 inches, you see. Then bring it behind the screen. Say where you can see the aura. And, of course, bring the fingers all to the edge. They couldn't see the aura at all. And so there wasn't an aura licking the far side to be seen. So whatever, we wasn't accusing the medium of being untruthful, but whatever seeing an aura was and is not a straightforward visual thing. You know, and this is sort of sceptical, ruthless inquiry. And Arthur stood for that. So all these people were founder members of the network. And Andrew Gruzevsky brought Patrick Shackleton George Baker together. The network was founded. I think there was a meeting in Exeter University in 1973. I thought it was 72, but it was 73. So don't trust my memory too much. And the network was founded. It was originally a half-secret society, and it was quite different from today. Peter Leggett happened to be a particular friend of mine. And soon after the network was founded, He said, look, there's a very interesting organisation set up called the Scientific Medical Network. I think you ought to join it, Max. Much less eminent than the founders, but okay. Always need the odd backbench member. Said, yes, yes, yes. So, in fact, what happened was I received an invitation from George Blaker, went to London to a gentleman's club, and a conversation and gradually went deeper and deeper and deeper. So in the end, George obviously pondered about me a bit. Would you like to join? In these days, SMN's on the web and people encourage you to have public meetings. In those days, it was a semi-secret society and with a very restricted membership. And any proceeding, you were warned, this is private. And you mustn't say the meeting happened or who attended it or what was said without the permission of the entire meeting. Now, you think of how we do things today, you've got the difference. It was a different time. I think cultural attitudes have shifted, but that was the beginning of the network. But it gradually, I suppose I ought to reflect a bit further before I get comments, it became apparent fairly soon that the network was going bigger. The first 6 years, I say, it was run by Patrick Shackleton from Sidmouth. And then Patrick unfortunately fell ill and died. And it was taken over by George, who ran it for some time from Lake House near Dorking. But it became apparent that something had to be done to make it more efficient. And I think it was Peter Leggett, wasn't it, brought you in as a chairman for a council, Peter?
Yes.
And was it George or was it Peter brought you in as a director, David?
George.
George. He decided to, we will have an organisation, sort of an elected council with a chairman, who's Peter Fennick. And also, really, the thing needed a full-time professional to get it off, you know, get on wheels and get it moving. And David was recruited as our director. And the network, as it exists now, is due to the work put in by David and by Peter. I mean, David is now a consultant, so he's much freer to do good works than he was. And Peter is a president, but of course all the work is on Bernard's shoulders, the back row. But I think what we are now took the inheritance from the founders, and we've got two people here to thank for what we are now. If I think of the development of the network since, all kinds of good things have happened. We had our odd bumps, had to make our odd mistakes. We're not a colony of archangels. If I think of my own karma, I've got several awkward things to answer for, mistakes, but there we are. But I think there was a meeting in the Netherlands near Maastricht. I think it was a place called De Vorde. And I think we had a very interesting meeting then, which was quite crucial for the SMN. Because it'd been going for a long time, having conferences. Members of the SMN had been doing all kinds of useful things, advancing insights. But what did we actually stand for? It was quite a problem. And we could think of all kinds of definitions of we stand for that, we stand for that. You know, we suddenly realised that we couldn't and shouldn't describe the purpose of the network in terms of some particular dogmatic statement, you know, carved in stone or written in letters of fire. Because, first of all, it would be inadequate. Secondly, There's always going to be somebody who says, oh, no, no, it's not that, it's this. And thirdly, it's going to be out of date anyway as things advance. We didn't stand for any dogmatic creed or statement of reality. We stood for a process. And the process was openness, rigour, and mutual respect and love. And you pursue truth with total openness. You look at anything, anybody's point of view, any arguments, any alleged facts. You then examine them with all the rigour and honesty you're capable of. And lastly, you do it in a spirit of mutual respect and love. There are people you profoundly disagree with whose conclusions you think are wrong, indeed dangerous, indeed absurd. But they are people like you trying to pursue truth. You must respect them. They will make devastating comments about you. And you will receive those comments not with ferocious adversarial rebuttal, but you will realise that it's a point of view. And, you know, it's honest from their point of view and recognise why it is. And so the mutual respect and love, you know, is very the most difficult, of course. But you must unite that to the total openness and the ruthless rigour. And that has been, I think, the spirit of the network. Haven't always lived up to it. I mean, if I think of all things we've done, we've been pretty good at openness. And our mutual love hasn't been too bad. There are those who say we could have been more rigorous, but okay, you know, everybody. But at least we've got the threefold ideal. And that has been my recollection of the history of the network. It's purely my personal recollection. I've got a little plenty of time before we went in the drink, but I wondered if anybody got any points or observations or questions, or above all, corrections. I have said I had this lovely conversation with Desna and realised I was not dealing adequately with Patrick. I'm sure I haven't dealt adequately with anybody else. So please, comments.
I'm very sorry if our conversation this morning yes. seemed like corrections. I didn't mean it to.
Desna, I'm so glad you added my further insights.
There are just two or three things I'd like to say. Please.
Go on.
Which is really lovely to hear. And I'm so pleased, too, to have talked to you this morning, because you're a person who knew my father, which not many people left in the network really did know my father, because he unfortunately died at the rather near the beginning. But one of the things that strikes me straight away is the reason why, to begin with, the network was regarded as a semi-secret society. And that was that at that time, we're talking about the early 70s, it was actually something that could wreck your career if you spoke freely about things which were outside the conventional received wisdom in science and medicine, and probably still now, but less so, I guess. Mm. But that was the reason at the beginning why it was decided to keep it as something that was, when I say secret, it simply was that it was wanting to be very, very open, allow members to be totally open, and therefore it couldn't be made absolutely generally enormously public. Mm. Just two other little things. One is that I just wanted to say something about Andrew Gosiewski, who was a very good friend of my father,
And I was there quite often at the early meetings because we lived only about 5 or 6 miles away, and my father was a great communicator, and so he kept me in very much in the loop as things as they went along, which was fascinating. I have still got some papers which I must hand over. What I just wanted to say about Andrew was that we used to go down, and I had small children at the time, and we used to go down to visit Andrew. He, of course, was a Polish priest who was looking after a community of Poles in Newton Abbot in Devon. I mean, an absolutely delightful and wonderful man, and very, very sort of... I won't say impressive because he was so accessible, but he was a marvelous man. And we used to go and visit, and my children absolutely adored it because he lived in what I can only describe as quite a large hut. And he kept, he grew plants, and his plants totally filled the inside of his hut and went right up to the roof all the way around. And as he explained, he talked to them a great deal, and he loved them and they loved him. You know, it was as simple as that. The other just tiny thing was, well, it isn't tiny, it was a very big thing at the time, was that you mentioned Kelvin Spencer as being rather narrow, perhaps, because of the Ministry of Power context. But, of course, when Kelvin retired, he immediately became extremely interested in alternative technology. And, in fact, there's a watermill at Branscombe, where he was living, which was quite near Sidmouth, so that he and my father saw each other daily. He became interested in the idea of restoring that mill. Well, actually, that didn't happen, but I restored one a few miles away and made flour there for 25 years. So that's all I wanted to add, really.
Thank you, Desmond. Now, Annie, please.
I actually had a question which I think perhaps you've answered, but I'll ask it anyway in case there's more to it. I was curious to know what was the original intent and goal behind the SMN, and in particular, how did the founders differentiate it from what the SPR was doing at the time? Was it simply a matter of secret versus public, or was there some... Because there seemed to be a lot of overlapping interests.
Yeah, well, obviously, yes, you're right about the overlapping with the SPR. But in terms of aims, I think the point was there weren't any. All they wanted to do was to bring together scientists who realised the limitations of the very efficient but very dogmatic, limiting, materialist hypothesis that all scientists officially work to. And they want to bring scientists who could see beyond that limitation and what was on the outside. And, of course, there's all kinds of directions on the outside. Do you follow me? So they didn't have a particular goal. There was sort of anything beyond the frontier, point one. Your second point.
Well, it's really about the SPR. Why didn't they just throw in their lot?
The SPR was certainly, if you like, a parallel organisation, but the SPR was thought to be, and possibly correctly, is regarded as simply concerned with a rather narrow but very important area of experience, namely certain forms of, can I use it, paranormal phenomena, particularly associated with survival after death, but other things like that. And it was again felt that they've got a particular area, but the scientific and medical network is concerned with a far bigger area. I mean, where does acupuncture fit in as far as the SPR is concerned? It's not, do you follow me? Where does dowsing fit in? Not exactly SPR territory. Psychokinesis, some of it yes, some of it no. There's a vast area of phenomena outside the official boundary of what is permissible in the world according to a strict and materialist dogma. and it goes in all kinds of directions medically and scientifically. And the SPR just seems to be focusing in that way. Am I answering your question?
Can I comment on that, Martin?
Just to say that what George told me was that the common concern between Patrick and George and the other founders was that young scientists were being indoctrinated into materialism, so that there was not a proper distinction between science and scientism. Mm. I.e. science as a method and a process and open form of inquiry, and science as an ideology, which is a materialistic ideology, and this situation is still very much the case, as Pim was explaining this morning. And so there's still all that work to be continued. That's the first thing. The second thing is that George's remark about the relationship between the SMN and the SPR was that there was a specific interest in spirituality in the network, which was not a specific interest in the SPR. and that was grounded, in the case of the founders, all of them, in mystical experience. They all had this. Mm. They all had mystical experience.
Yeah.
They all knew that there was a different way of knowing. They all knew that there was more to life than the material plane, and they wanted to be able to explore and express this and open this up for young people, which is why a very important component of the network program in the early days was the Wider Horizons program for 18 to 25 year olds, where people would be able to be exposed to ideas that were not available in a university setting, and which could do with the personal development, with meaning, with the nature of consciousness, nature of reality.
Has David answered your question?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Please.
A little bit more about our Father Andrew Grzeszewski. Terrible Polish pronunciation. He was also a bit of a scientist. Which may explain how he knew George Blaker, possibly.
He didn't know George Blaker. He somehow found out about him.
Okay.
Mm. He was Rican Trust. He was very connected with Rican Trust.
Okay. Yes. Well, I just want to say I have an off-print of a paper of his printed in radio something or other in 1950, which was about the music of plants and humans.
Ah, that... Now, again, I hope I get some extra information out of this session. Thank you very much. Any other... Please.
I just wanted to come in on this question of spirituality in the network, because when I first went down to see George, as David has indicated and you have indicated, they were very free and open as to what we did. Mm-hmm. But George made it quite clear, and he would look at you with his piercing blue eyes so you couldn't look away. And he talked about a spiritual impulse for the network. Mm. And so it was there right from the very beginning. Mm. And I think that actually has always been important. And we're through it now, but we went through a phase as to whether the S word could ever be mentioned in our literature, although we were perfectly happy to talk about it at meetings. It's rather like the Victorians, wasn't it, covering up the legs of chairs and things. Could we actually do this in public or not? And we finally did that. But the other thing is, you were talking about De Verda and finding out who we were. The other time was, of course, in Wales, and you probably remember that.
1993.
When we set the network guidelines.
Yes.
And in fact, that was when we had our first retreat.
Abergadolwy, was it?
Abergadolwy, it absolutely was. And we then realized that if we were going to have this different form of meeting, then there had to actually be guidelines. And so we set then about defining the guidelines as they are now. And that was another moment which took us forward.
And then the most important room in George's house was the blue room, where he meditated. And everybody who went down to visit him would join him in his meditations. And it was very, very quiet, blue carpet, blue curtains and so on, and that was a kind of spiritual centre.
Very
strong atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to see the people who bought the house, whether they, you know, pick that up.
Please.
And George, I'll just tell you one other story about George, because this was, I joined the network in 1983 when I was teaching at Winchester. George used to make cards up for everybody. And so everybody had an index card with his notes on the person. And there was one, actually, this is not the story I was going to tell, but I'll come back to him. Susan Blackmore was a member of the network for quite a long time. Then she resigned. And across the card was the following note by George: succumbed to materialism. Which is very, very nice. Anyway, what happens, George, I soon after I joined, because I got this letter from nowhere, I had no idea, and what's in the Scientific and Medical Network, and there was a sheet of paper describing the aims of the network, sort of cyclo-style sheet of paper, which had been photocopied many times, you could just about read it. And I thought, well, this just sounds the thing for me. And so I joined, and I arranged to go and have lunch with George. And we hadn't got very far into the lunch in the Crown Inn in Ockley when he turned to me and he said, "You're just the sort of person we're looking for to run the network." And, you know, everything has unfolded from there. But this is George. George had very distinct ideas and plans.
So we've got over there, I think.
Well, it's just a reflection, and I'll check this out with you, but I was very... moved, actually, I was very moved by the Blue Room. You could feel it right here. Mm. But I was very moved when you were saying that in the early days, the Scientific and Medical Network was very restrictive.
Yeah.
And I was dead scared of it. I found it very easy to get involved with the PSR, the Psychical Research Society. Mm. I got involved with something I think David remembers, which was something called Alternative Media Group. Which George Trevelyan was involved with, another fairly terrifying individual as he walked around with his very piercing blue eyes.
Mm. Yeah.
And also, I remember that, you know, the SMN was something you didn't touch, unless you were a bona fide Harley Street surgeon, scientist, or whatever it happened to be. And one of the very positive things that I've found with the network over the years is the way that it's broadened its scope and made it much, much more open to people who are interested in the field but who are not hardline researchers in the field to be able to be involved with the work. Mm. And I find that in network and in the books that have been published, I find this to be a really, really exciting and positive development. Mm. And I think almost, I would want to say, as somebody who comes, I got in, I think, because I was working for World Service, and I think they thought it'd be a bit of good publicity. Mm. That particular area, to see someone like, the presentation this morning, Pim Lommel, with absolute scientific basis, but that broadening out of the implications, I find is typical of the best work that the network has done. And I just wanted to offer you that reflection.
Yes, sorry, I think there's two people here, aren't there? There's Tony and then Beata. Beata.
Sorry.
Well, I'd like to support what we've just heard. When I decided to join the network, being urged to do so by Ian Gordon Brown and Barbara Summers, I wrote a letter to George Blaker, and I said that I was not a doctor and I was not a scientist. I was a psychotherapist, but my interest really coincided with what I understood the network was about. And if I promised to be very quiet, could I become a member? And I had the most charming reply from George saying, yes, provided I won't be too quiet.
Which you haven't been. No.
David, you have an anecdote about George Blaker and Gandhi.
Yes. Would you like me to tell it?
Yes, please.
Yes. George was... correct me if I'm wrong.
Similar.
Yeah, so he was taking some does a walk down from where he was staying. And a car, as he was walking, I don't know whether he got to the end of his walk, but anyway, a car came past and offered him a lift, and he thought it would be bad taste or form not to take this lift. So he got into the car, and in the back was Gandhi. And he started to try and make a bit of conversation to Gandhi, but Gandhi didn't say anything at all. And so he was slightly perplexed about this, and so he got out of the car at the top and thanked the driver and said, and the driver then explained this was actually Gandhi's silent day. And he wasn't talking to anyone, so it wasn't personal to George at all.
Could I add to that story? As George told it, similar as a hill station, very steep in the Himalayas like that, and the meeting was in the top here, and a series of parallel roads going down the hillside on the steep Himalayan slope, and George, relaxing, between meetings, had walked down the hill and suddenly realised he'd got to get back up the top again, and it's rather easy enough to walk downhill, and he was late and he'd got to walk all the way uphill, and this car came and he got into it. And he was grateful. He didn't recognise Gandhi at first. The whole point, but he thought he ought to say things to thank. And the other occupant, it was the way the car. He got in the front next to the driver, and this man in the back, you see. And George would turn around and make the odd remark, and this nice man in the back would nod, but not say a word. And George was rather puzzled by that. And then the car stopped and let George out. And the chauffeur said, "It's all right. It's just Mr. Gandhi's day of silence, you know." That's
very good.
Capping the story. Mm. Please, any one over here.
Who created the title and included medical?
Oh, Patrick Shackleton.
Pardon?
Patrick Shackleton.
Why was medical put in? Because it seems scientific would include it.
You told us the story.
Now, I'm curious.
All I can say is he was a dean of medicine, not a dean of science. These labels, if you're academic, labels matter. Medicine is medicine, medical, okay.
Yeah.
I should add as well, Eric, that there was always a policy of George to invite intuitives to join. And so there were some people who were specifically written to by George to join the network as intuitives, because what they were looking for was the combination of rational analysis and intuitive insight. Yeah. So neither was thought to be complete in itself, but each could complement each other, which is why that has run as a theme through the development of the network.
Just one comment, which has nothing to do with it, but you mentioned the linear motor driving trains.
Yes.
Well, that project was cancelled by Mrs. Thatcher because she couldn't see any future using it.
That's the history of British technology, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, well.
He used also some uses technology for another demonstration. Definitely I can explain. He gave it.
Go on, current over you, go on.
He gave demonstrations to an audience, and using the electromagnet, he put something in the on his desk, and under this, nobody knew there was electromagnet.
Yeah.
And he showed how he asked the people in the audience to have ohm, and when there was ohm, then he started the electromagnet, and it's levitate. And then he asked the audience what they've seen. And what I heard from him, that he'd seen three types from the audience. The people who didn't believe say, nothing happened, it didn't levitate at all. Some people who were more spiritual say, oh, I've seen some spirit coming and lying. So what he mentioned, that what people believe, that's what they see. Yeah. So this was using his electronic... Also, I just want to thank you. It was fascinating to see your memories, that how you... really remember all the things that were like 40 years ago, which is fascinating, all this story. So thank you for this.
Subject you will observe to be to correction. Doesn't it?
Yes, I just wanted to say that my father always said that medicine is both a science and an art. Mm. And he was a healer as well, as Max has mentioned. And he also insisted that entrance to Southampton Medical School, anybody who was going for it, had to have an arts A-level as well as their sciences. Is that all right?
Peter, I think yours is the last contribution.
Just to talk about the broadening of the network, which I think was very important. When I joined the network, you could only join it if you had a university degree. And we were a very exclusive bunch of people. And, of course, there's all this secret side of it, etc. And the intuitives that David was talking about were always described as leavening. So it was the scientist leavened by the intuitives, which was great. And then we decided that probably we were being a bit restrictive in just having university people, so it was okay to have another degree. I mean, you could have a nursing qualification, that would be okay. Or you could have a technology qualification, that was all right. And then we felt that this was really totally pointless. And that what we wanted was the quality of people who were attracted to the network and who wanted to be with us and could contribute. And so we then went through the phase of just having people's names before us in the council, and we could say yes or no. And then that was seen as being pointless, so why not put it on the net? And so many of you, I think, may have joined, or some of you, I hope, will have joined, just on the net. And that, I thought, was a wonderful way of getting people into the network. So I think this is what we've done. And as we've seen, we've already heard that people, if they get too materialistic, of course, they'll reject themselves. And if they're too spiritual, it may not be rigorous enough for them. So we run this very nice balance between the two.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Peter. And Max, did you want to... Has to be a PS.
It was striking that all the founders you talked about in your wonderful talk had a mystical experience, which was so powerful that they had to change.
Yes.
And that was the start of the... And it's so important, but you have such mystical experience, you change your consciousness and you change your worldview, and you have to change. You cannot stop it anymore. And so that is a wonderful explanation how it started. Thank you for your wonderful talk.
I remember Max when he retired. Max was professionally a philosopher of religion, philosopher of science, taught at Sheffield Hallam University for many years. And he said, when I retired, I obtained nirvana. But luckily, he's come back from Nirvana to be with us this afternoon. And I'd just like you to join me in thanking Max for his insight and wisdom and humour.